Today's guest has been described as a mover and a shaker in the animation world, and that's probably putting it mildly. William Joyce is a force in entertainment for young audiences. One of his more recent works is The Numberlees, a book about a world in which there are no letters and no colors, but the heroes create the alphabet and everything else follows along with this. It might take less time to list the things William Joyce does not do, but we'll go at this the traditional way. He makes films and apps and books. He wrote the books upon which the animated film The Rise of the Guardians, you know, with Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and all, was based. He's also been involved in the Toy Story movies, won Emmy Awards for the TV series Roly Poly Oly, and created covers for The New Yorker. This is not the William Joyce who teaches at the Dartmouth College Business School, but we're glad to have this one. William Joyce, thanks for joining us.
I don't know. How do you know I didn't teach at the Dartmouth Business School?
When I looked at the 4+2 method for building market share, I really didn't think that was your kind of stuff.
Well, at least you're not confusing me with the famous English traitor named William Joyce, who was known as Lord Ha Ha.
Oh, him? That was William Joyce, too?
Yeah, that was my historical doppelganger. So when my books are published in England, it's always William E. Joyce, so I won't, like, conjure up, you know, memories of that kind of mellifluous traitor who's trying to talk Britain into giving up the ghost.
Lord Ha Ha was like the continental version of Tokyo Rose, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's extremely, like, she really should be fighting, you chaps. I mean, it's a lost cause. And they, as soon as the war was over, they shot that guy as fast as they could.
Well, yes, all the more reason then to be identified as William E. Joyce.
There you go.
In Britain.
I wish I did know math at Dartmouth. That'd be kind of awesome.
That'd be another set of skills to have, but it sounds like you developed quite a few over the years when I think about the fact that you moved from, I mean, you're adept at everything, watercolors, acrylics, pencils, and off into computers for a long time now, it seems.
Yeah, I guess, and making up a good, or hopefully good yarn. And I don't know, my interests are far-ranging and my enthusiasms are unending, and so I get to piddle in my favorite sandboxes and people pay me.
Tell us about the household you grew up in, William Joyce. I mean, your parents clearly encouraged your creativity.
Well, it was like, you can't take it with you, but with humidity is the way I like to describe it. Because I grew up in Louisiana, and it was a boisterous, large and boisterous household, and I was the youngest, and so, you know, there were all these, one cousin was at Juilliard and was studying concert piano, and another was an opera singer, and another was a writer, and my sister was an artist, my other sister was a photographer, and one cousin was an actor, and, you know, I just went, so there's all this stuff going on, and there I was, this little kid walking amongst it, and it sort of wore off on me, and the line between fact and fiction was blurry as a kid, and it stayed blurry as an adult.
Was there one cartoon character that you looked at as a kid that made you say, you know, I want to do something like that someday?
Well, I liked Bugs Bunny more than anybody because he just seemed to get away with everything, and then the Fleischer Brothers versions of Superman were just extraordinary. So it was like, if I could just merge the mischief and wise quackery of Bugs Bunny with a guy who could fly and be invincible, that was kind of where I wanted to go.
These are the Fleischer cartoons of the 30s and 40s with the Bud Collier voice?
I assume so. I'll say yes to that.
All right, so yeah, where Clark Kent sounded kind of mild, and he said, this is a job for Superman.
Superman, yeah. As he goes into that you know, antique notion of a phone booth. And, you know, I watch this with my kids, and they're just like, why doesn't he use a cell phone? I'm like, yeah.
Okay. It's hard to, yeah, forget it. We'll try to come back and explain this some other day, right?
Right.
In addition to your family, which obviously was just brimming with creativity, you have spoken of having very supportive teachers in school as well, but did things change a bit when you got to college?
You know, I got to school and I already sort of developed my painting style, and they wanted me to abstract when I got to college. It was, you know, late 70s, early 80s, and realism was just so, you know, frowned upon. I'm like, God, it was just like mimicry. I mean, what? No, we abstract. And I was like, well, I abstracted when I was four. you know, I have a vision in my head. I want to tell these sort of narrative paintings. And they're like, that's not art. And I'm like, well, isn't that what, you know, Da Vinci was doing? I mean, isn't that what Michelangelo did in the Sistine Chapel? Those are narrative paintings, and they're art. So why do I have to paint it on a ceiling in a church for it to be art? And, you know, it's just, they were smug about, no. And so representation was dead. And so I changed to film school because I couldn't take their sort of haughtiness about what I wanted to do. And I wanted to tell stories visually, so it was the perfect merge of, you know, images that tell stories. I like to do images. I wanted to tell stories. Film school was a great training ground for making films and then making picture books.
All kinds of great stuff still left to talk about with William Joyce. You know, you just can't say as you go up to a break how many things he's done. We left out the Oscar already for the fantastic flying books of Mr. Morris Lessmore, which, of course, he created in book form as well. We'll come back and talk more with William Joyce and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is William Joyce, the creator. It's just easier to call him a creator because he's an animator, he's an illustrator, he is an author. He has gotten books and movies and apps and so much more out there in the world. You might remember The Rise of the Guardians. That was based on his books about the Guardians, and it's Santa Claus and Easter Bunny reimagined in new ways. And his most recent work is called The Numberlees. It's with illustrator Christina Ellis. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about the creative process and the work William Joyce has pumped out over the years. 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. William E. Joyce. It's been almost 30 years since William Shrinks. Was that your first book?
That was George Shrinks, yes.
George Shrinks. Wow, okay.
It was my first book. My God, it's been 30 years. Oh, my God. Amazing.
Wow. Yeah. Were you holding down a day job at the time?
No. I mean, that was what was interesting about the luck of my career, is that I've always been able to make a living at making up stuff. And it's kind of wish fulfillment, and it's like getting paid for recess.
Really? So, you know, it's one of those things where people say, hey, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. Has it been like that for you?
It is, but, you know, also, you remember how tired you'd be after recess sometimes?
You need the nap, yeah.
Yeah. It's the making up of things is arduous and delightful, and collaborating with people and movies and television shows and all the different things is really invigorating, exciting. But at the end of the day, you're tired, and then it's the actual business part of it. You know, the business of making a film is contrary to, like, you know, the whimsy and delights of just making things up. It is very grounded in fact. And so when they give you $120 million to make a movie, man, they're worried about that money. And when they're worried about that money, they're standing over your shoulder and they're trying to make sure you're not misspending it. And then it's like, you know, go ahead, pretend we're not here, but it's like you've got the principal standing watching you the entire time. And so it comes with caveats now.
I have often wondered about how that much creativity gets to the end of the process, actually gets onto the screen, given those great concerns that you do have, you know, the suits, basically, the people who are concerned about the dollars and cents and the market research and the audiences and all that stuff, saying, well, how about you try it this way? I mean, how much intervention goes on a daily or hourly basis with what the creative people are doing?
You know, it varies with each company. It varies with each project. It's if you're all, like, at the beginning of this process, if you're talking to the boss, the guy who runs the studio, and you tell him a story, and he likes that story, and he says, I want to make that story. If you know that from the beginning, everything's a little bit easier. But if you start this thing out and you tell the story to the second person in command, and they say, I like that story, and maybe we should do this, and maybe we should do that. And you're like, well, I'm not sure. And they go, well, what do you think? And I go, well, okay, maybe. And then they go, okay, we'll make this. And then you know, like, since it's not 100% from the beginning, that you're going to have a rougher time. And but if you know from the beginning that they dig what you've got, it's going to be a lot easier. And but then sometimes the guy that you agreed to do this movie with gets fired, heads of studios come and go, and then you got a new guy, and he may not like this idea at all. And then you have a lot of trouble. So, you know, but the day-to-day of just making stuff up for the movies is mostly really euphoric and fun and hard, but you hope that it'll make it all the way through. My agent tells me all the time, don't worry, most bad ideas die. And he's right about that. It's the okay ideas that get through that can kind of mess up a movie. Yeah. The ones that aren't 100%, and it only takes a few of them to really just put a dent in your beautiful car.
It's so weird the way that movies have moved beyond this realm of, like, this is great art, and it's so much about dollars and cents. And I'm not just talking about in the studio end, but so much of the reaction, too, seems to be gauged in dollars. It's like, well, this better be a good movie because it cost $120 million. And, you know, in fact, even just looking for information about the reaction to Rise of the Guardians, I had two totally different characterizations of it. One was like, oh, it was this wonderful success, and the other one was it was a box office flop. You know, so people seem to graft onto movies what their own perceptions were from the get-go.
Well, I mean, a box office flop that made $300 million. you know? it's like, okay. I mean, it made a profit, mm-hmm. and it did not. Initially, they were worried it wouldn't, but, you know, and then in worldwide box office and then on DVD and everything, it made back all its money, so it was a success. And but the bar is so nutty. I mean, they're like, it has to make $600 million to be considered a big success. And it's like, guys, maybe we shouldn't be spending so much money on these things so we can make $300 million and feel really good about that.
Right.
Which is why I formed my own studio, why I'm doing all these things myself now. I mean, Numberlees is a story that I wanted to tell, a telling of how the alphabet came to be, but as a sort of epic, whimsical adventure. And at my studio here, Moonbot, you know, we start with story ideas that are books, and then we build out from them. And so we did a short film based on what the book was becoming, and an app that was based on both those things, and now we're doing a television series that, you know, will be part of all of that. And but we were able to get our vision across on our own, inexpensively, and without a great deal of interference or worry about from people who were worried about how the money was being spent. And so that's the way we did our Oscar-winning film, The Fantastic Flying Books of Morris Lesmore, which then became a very successful app and a very successful book. So we're trying to keep the purity of our vision intact by doing it cheaper and without all the fear and terror that goes with it. I've made big movies. It's always filled with a lot of anxiety. It's great fun. It's like going to the greatest amusement park there is, but, you know, that roller coaster can be scary sometimes. So we're trying to exist in more of a really cool putt-putt course environment.
Instead of Augusta National?
Yes.
William Joyce is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, creative force with Moonbot Studios. He has made motion pictures, he has made books, he's made apps, you name it, he's done it. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
I can't pretend to have as much fun as you guys seem to sound like on the radio like this. Basically, I would like to ask your guest. There was a television show back when I was a little child. I remember watching it. Steven Spielberg did it. It was one of the episodes he did, and in that he had as part of this so-called science fiction thing, it turned out to be like the main character. He had monoxide poisoning. It was like some like fever dream. They were talking in numbers, and I'd like to know Jeffrey, you glanced upon that he's thinking about maybe there might be a future where people just don't talk in words anymore. They like talk in individual digits, like numbers, like uh-huh. You know what this one is. You know, one is this, and 10 is that.
Sure, I joke with the kids rather than swearing. You're going to say you're 17.
I'll take the answer off the telephone.
All right, okay? Thanks, Jamie. Appreciate it. So, you recognize the Steven Spielberg story he's talking about?
I do not. Mm-hmm. But it's always intrigued me that there could be one or the other, but what would happen if there weren't both, you know? And so in the Numberlys, it's like they have a nice life. It's very orderly, but they want something more. And it just seemed like I wanted to make this an epic adventure about how the alphabet came to be, and I didn't want it based on any reality. I just wanted to make the point that language is important, and so it's a huge struggle for them to do this. It goes against the grain of their society to try this different thing, but it enriches it. And I got most of my inspiration from another science fiction film, Metropolis, the great silent film by Fritz Lang.
It's really interesting to look at that book, and it reminds us that entertainment that is aimed primarily at children actually has to work on two levels, doesn't it? Because you have to, I mean, there's the fun stuff for the kids, like, ooh, look at the pretty letters coming out of the assembly line. But the adults have to get some of this, too. They have to have some reason to stay awake during this thing.
Well, that's been my whole, like, raison d'etre, is, like, I try to appeal to the kid and every grown-up and to the adult and every kid, and because then everybody's having a good time. And so the compliment I like the most is when people tell me, I've read one of your books a million times to my kids, and I still, you know, enjoy it. And so, yes, it's best when you can function on both levels. But kids want to be challenged, you know. So the idea of, you know, taking Metropolis and trying to adapt it to kids sounds ridiculous and too sophisticated, but that's exactly the kind of thing that they gravitate towards, is something unexpected, something magnificent, something huge and beautiful. And that I think we shortchange them sometimes by making stuff so cute. Just, you know, give them something that's challenging, and that's what I always try to do.
And the look of Metropolis in particular, I'll tell you, it appealed to me from the time I was a teenager, too, and it took me years and years to finally see the film.
Yeah.
All the way
I know.
Through.
I mean, it was like, I was the same way. It was like this thing I knew about and had seen images of, but I hadn't seen the film. And then I finally saw the film in film school, but it was like, it was missing an hour. You know, they had, it only just was restored like 2 or 3 years ago, and it was supposed to be its original form. And all this footage had been lost for decades and decades, and they found a bunch of it down in Argentina and cobbled it back together. And it was like, oh, my gosh, not as it just – I'd always thought of it as a magnificent-looking curiosity, but it never did make much sense. The narrative, but with this missing hour restored, it was like, oh, my – the narrative is as magnificent as the imagery. It all supports itself. And I was like, kids need to see this. Kids need to have this sense of grandeur. They need to be exposed to that. And just thinking of it as a picture book with, you know, happy bunnies bouncing around. No way, man. Let's go for Metropolis.
Yeah, it's a good look. It's a really interesting book, The Numberlys. But you're not the ultimate illustrator here. Christina Ellis is that right?
No, we work together. Mm-hmm. You know, part of the trajectory of my career has been, once I started my own studio, I have a number of, you know, hired a number of extremely talented artists, and I have my own style, but I also get bored with my own style, and I want to sort of broaden that. And some of these stories seem like they needed a different approach. So, you know, I decided to collaborate with some of my artists, and let's forge a new style for that would support the story for each book. Christina's an extraordinarily talented young woman with a great whimsical imagination. And so it was really delightful for to work together. I mean, I would kind of design stuff and figure out the compositions, and she would add her own bits of ingenuity to it and do a lot of the painting. And it was just a nice back and forth. It's a way I never expected to work early in my career, but I've done it on two books now, and it's three, actually. There's another one coming out that I worked with another one of our artists, and it's delightful. I mean, I'm taking these young artists and helping them learn the craft of illustration, the craft of making a book and a story, and I hope I'm helping, you know, forge a new group of talents that are going to carry on the tradition, but also help me, you know, find new ways to do stuff.
Artist, author, and filmmaker William Joyce is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. So at Moonbot Studios, have you hired some pretty good business staff? I mean, I guess...
Yes, we do. Oh, my God, yes. Those poor people trying to tame Monkey Island.
Well, that was the question, was whether you've managed to keep yourself in the creative end of things or whether you have to have meetings with the accounting staff. And
well, sort of they would throw me out. We have very, very strong, very smart, very astute business people who I have nothing but sympathy for as we run around, you know, swinging from the rafters and reaching midair, trying to find some magic and goofing around and laughing our asses off. And it looks like we're not really doing anything, but we're actually making up something. But they walk through and they're very sweet, and they throw us a banana every now and then.
And the complete works of Shakespeare emerge.
Yeah.
Right. In cartoon form. So I have to believe your head is fairly bursting with ideas. I mean, do some of your characters first come to life, William Joyce, on napkins or beer mats?
Oh, my God, yes. You know, no, some of the best stuff happens in restaurants and bars. I mean, you know, I'm looking at – we have all these boards in all our offices that are you know – packed up with jillions of sketches, and I'm looking at the one in my office, and it probably 40% of the stuff that's pinned up is either a cocktail napkin or a part of a paper tablecloth from a restaurant that I doodled on. It's where I do some of my best work. It's where some of my best ideas come from, and they usually have, you know, a little bit of a olive oil stain on one, and there's a little Merlot stain on the other. And at one point, we were being sued over the movie Robot. Somebody said that we had stolen their idea and stolen their designs. But I was able to produce the paper tablecloth from the first drawing I did for the main character of that film, and I had the American Express, you know, bill from that night, and can prove that came from that restaurant on a day that long preceded when these people said they had made up all this stuff. And so it ended up working in my favor and saving the day in a infringement trial that never needed to start.
Oh, to be there for that moment. Your Honor, I introduce Exhibit
awesome.
C.
Your Honor! May I present Exhibit A?
So how long does it take, though, this process to go from, for example, from napkin to finished story, either in book or in film form? I mean, this can take years.
You know, it just depends. I mean, I think the longest I spent on anything was probably Rise of the Guardians. That percolated in my idea and my head for about 20 years before I was able to really rein it in. And a lot of that with the reining in came from, you know, the fact that I sold the idea to DreamWorks Animation, and then from then on I was on a ticking clock, and they were like, figure this out. And it worked for me to have that kind of pressure. Once we started on the movie, it was 5 years before the movie came out, and that's fast for an animated film. When we're doing something on our own at Moonbot, and, you know, when we do a short film or something like that, it's basically, it just depends. I mean, on Numberly's, literally, we're sitting around and our publisher and some folks at Apple were asking us, what do we have planned for the holidays? And we're like, well, we're going to, you know, we're going to open Christmas presents right now. what are you going to have come out for the holidays? And we're like, we don't know yet. Can you give us a few minutes? And we sat there, and I've been thinking about the Numberlys a bit, done some rough drawings for it. And I said, well, let's do the Numberlys. It seems pretty easy. and within 15 minutes, we had decided that's what we were going to do. And so 6 months later, we were done.
The Numberlys is one of the latest books out of the hands of William Joyce. He did it with illustrator Christina Ellis, and it's just one in a long, long string of works he's made in painting, in pictures, in books, in cartoons, in animated film, all kinds of stuff coming out of William Joyce. We'll talk more with William and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is William Joyce. Creative force is probably the best way to describe him. He has been involved in so many things, from New Yorker covers to movies to children's books. You'll know him from his work. He's actually been involved in the Toy Story movies. He was involved with the original stories that led to the movie The Rise of the Guardians about Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. He's won an Emmy Award for Roly Poly Oly, an Oscar for the Fantastic Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lesmore, and he's our guest on the Exchange, and you can listen in and you can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or jx@jeffnet.org. William, we were just talking about The Rise of the Guardians just a bit and how long it took to get that onto the screen.
Mm-hmm.
You had a lot of fun with Santa Claus over the years. I went back and looked at some of the New Yorker covers, like December 26th or The Night After Christmas.
Right.
A fun one with the whole naughty and nice theme. Is it hard, though, to take a character that is just so ingrained in so many people's minds and give it a new twist, as you did with the Nicholas St. North interpretation?
Well, this is, I tell you, it's like it was me getting revenge on like my parents being unable to answer any question about Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy or the Easter Bunny with any conviction, I'll go, how do they do this? I mean, this is amazing. I mean, he gets the whole planet in one night. And everybody gets a present. I mean, come on, how does he do it? They're like, well, he just does, you know. And I'm like, well, come on, give me some details. I mean, you know, this can't be something that just sort of breezes by. I mean, you know, if we know, you know, what the Russians are doing in Yugoslavia, we must know what's going on, you know, with this guy. And he's like, well, he just does, and it's just magic, and that's that. And so I'm like, okay, tell me about the Easter Bunny. I mean, you know, is he big? You know what? And he just is. I mean, we just go to bed, and that's what happens. And so, you know, I was like, I think I might have, you know, hung on to the myth a little longer, because it was a heartbreaker when I found out the truth. And because I really didn't expect them, you know, to tell me that
there is no Santa Claus.
Well, yeah. I wouldn't say that out loud, man. You don't know who's listening. You know, use coded words. They were myths. And and so when I found that out, I was just like, well, dang. And it haunted me. I was 5 years old when I asked the question. It was in August, you know, of all things, because you're always thinking about that stuff when you're a kid. I asked my dad, you know, tell me about Santa Claus. He said, do you really want to know? And I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, what? So the fact that he said, do you really want to know, meant that to me that he had something amazing to tell me. And so I'm like, yeah, I really want to know. He goes, are you sure? And I'm like, absolutely. This is getting great. And he goes, no. You know, there is none. And I'm like, wait a minute. Can we rewind?
can we unring the bell?
Yeah, I don't want to know this. And I was just devastated, because then they all died. You know, like there's not Santa Claus, and the rest of them are gone too. And it was a dark day for mythology in my life at that point. And so I had kids of my own, and like, okay, now I get to pass on this amazing gift that we have as a society. We've decided, you know, as a civilization, that we will tell our children that these mythic people actually exist, and we will go to great lengths as a people to make them believe something that isn't true. That's remarkable, you know. And there wasn't like a legislative, you know, act that called upon this to happen. It evolved, and it's it's always evolving. It's been around sometimes, you know, some of the myths are as old as 2,000 years, and they haven't gone away, and that we keep doing that. I'm like, I thought about it as an adult and a parent. I'm like, this is amazing that we do this, because that's just not, you know, at heart, humans sometimes aren't that whimsical, and that they would do this thing, and do it generation after generation, and stand by it, I think is awesome. And now I realize I can be a part of that. You know, I'm going to pass this on to my kids. And then I want to do books about this that reinforce this idea, this mythology, make it stronger, answer the questions that my parents wouldn't or couldn't answer, or give a plausible explanation. And but it really kicked in when my daughter was about 3.5, and my son was 2.5, and they came in their pajamas, and like at some time that had nothing to do with Christmas or anything, and they said, I know what it was. My son had just lost a tooth, and my daughter said, does Santa Claus know the Tooth Fairy? And I was like, really good question. And so I started making things up on the spot. I didn't just tell her that I don't know, you know, like my parents had. And that began the 20-year, you know, thing of the rise of the Guardians. And I really wanted to give them a great, magnificent mythology to make them bigger than life, as they seemed, you know, in my mind as a kid. You know, they are magnificent beings, heroic, Wagnerian, you know, titans of childhood, and they defend you from, you know, they defend your dreams. They defend the strongest elements of childhood against being eroded, and they keep you from being afraid, or they try to keep you from being afraid, and they protect you from the one guy that seemed the most logical to be the problem. That would be the boogeyman.
Right, Pitch Black.
Pitch Black.
Yeah, real sinister character there. And I've wondered about walking that fine line of scary in something where you're. I mean, you got Santa Claus, and you got the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy, and the Sandman, but you got the scary character too.
Yeah.
And I wonder about, you know, if there were lots of little finaglings in the process of trying to make sure that he was challenging, and he was going to be a problem for our heroes, but not ultimately one that could, you know, kill them, or, you know, have their heads burst open like in Game of Thrones or something.
Look, it was a very fine line, and one that we were very, very cognizant of. And I mean, I just the example that I kept using was the Wicked Witch of the West from The Wizard of Oz, and we all agreed that that Pitch, the boogeyman, needed to have, you know, enough like strength that you believed he could do harm, and you don't ever see the Wicked Witch of the West really do much other than, you know, fly on her broomstick and, you know, go away in a burst of red smoke.
Yeah, but that cackle.
But that cackle, and the way she looks and her demeanor and the way she delivered her lines and her costume, they all said, you know, bad news. And it, for many people growing up for a long time now, you know, who's the scariest thing? What's the scariest thing you ever saw in your kid? And they'll say the Wicked Witch of the West and her flying monkeys. And so, you know, we wanted to ride that fence of like, of how do you make him scary but not nightmare-inducing and not, you know, like somebody that's gonna really like worry you, as, you know, like enough of a problem that you feel like, you know, you got trouble if you're dealing with him. But if he's too benign, then you're just not worried about anybody. You know, you're not worried about whether he'll win or not, because he'll seem too bland. And a couple of the early versions of him were really scary, and it's all my fault. I was so excited to get to do something dark that I went way too far. But that's part of the process on these things. Is sometimes you got to break it to know that where you need what you're. limits are.
Yeah, you got to go big before you can bring it, reel it back in.
Yeah, and it's, oh, but there's some beautiful drawings. Oh, my God, they'll give you nightmares forever. And there was an early test animation, and it, we showed to Jeffrey Katzenberg, the head of DreamWorks, and he goes, this is beautifully made, you know, good job, and but this would be rated R, and we will know, we will be, you know, mothers will hunt us down and kill us, you know. So.
Yeah, you said so.
You've gotten that out of your system. Mm-hmm. You know? Let's pull her back in.
Well, the result was satisfying in the sense that, yes, there was a lot of menace there, but ultimately he could be defeated. We're talking to William Joyce on the Jefferson Exchange. Let's take a call from Mark in Reading. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. How difficult is it as an independent producer to get distribution? And also, approximately how many major distribution companies are there in the U.S.?
All right, good questions. Thanks for those, Mark.
Well, you know, what I end up doing, or what I've been, the way I started was, yes, I'm an independent producer, and I would come to them with my ideas, and I would go to the different studios, Disney, Warner Brothers, Paramount, Sony, present that idea, and if one of them liked it, then, you know, we'd make a deal, and then I would become a contract, you know, employee in a way. And but they're the only ones, or among the only ones, that have enough money to do those things. And so independently, trying to do these things independently is a lot harder, because animated movies just cost so much, and they take so long, and it takes quite a commitment to build the infrastructure to do that. So usually I went in there, you know, already kind of lined up with the animation division of one of these studios. In the case of Pixar, I mean, it was they were aligned with Disney when I did Robots, and I did Epic last year. I was aligned with Blue Sky, who I'd worked with and known them very well, and they're owned by Fox. So, you know, you find the shop that you like, and you see if they like what you're doing, and then they go to the studio. Once I decided to start doing this on my own, because it seemed viable now, like studios are looking for partners rather than having their own animation divisions, because it's just so expensive to have an animation division. Then I began to, like, okay, we can form this small company and convince them that we know what we're doing. We can get distribution through them and investment with them. And that's where we are now. We're at that point where we're trying to do that. When we do our short films, we fund it ourselves. But the short film is always geared in a way to try to make its money back, because we'll do an app and a book, because these things always, at least at Moonbot, start as a book, a storybook. And so we're able to bring, at least start showing our vision as a film in a smaller venue in a way that we can afford to produce and try to earn our money back on. But from that, we will then go around and try to shop our ideas to bigger studios. But having given them a clear taste of our vision and the fact that we've invested so much in that vision, that we come into it as partners and not as employees, so that we will, you know, hopefully earn more from the partnership rather than being an employee, like I described to you, it usually happens.
Given the amount of fun you have doing what you do, and you mentioned it's hard work too, but, you know, you've won Oscars, you've won Emmys, you've gotten this award for contributing to the literary life of Louisiana where you live. I mean, are they just gravy? I mean, is this sort of like, oh, that's nice?
Yeah, but isn't gravy the best part?
It's why I have Thanksgiving dinner every year, yeah.
I mean, come on. I mean, I got to tell you, man, it feels so good to get a pat on the back. I mean, you work so hard, and you don't do it for awards. You know, you do it because you've got this vision, you've got this story you want to tell, and you want to tell it so bad you're willing to put up your own money and take years of your life and, you know, risk so much to tell that story. But I tell you, it's as shallow as it sounds. It feels so good to get that pat on the back, that here, nice job. And I have to say, you know, winning an Oscar is the most fun I've ever had with my clothes on. I highly recommend it.
Final question then. About Centenary College, I understand, brought you in as the commencement speaker this year, and you threatened to bring in the usual cliches and set them on fire. Did you?
Yes.
What words of wisdom did you leave them with? 15 seconds, go.
How much wisdom I left behind, but I announced a number of cliches and you know, just sort of listed them off, and made sport of them, but at the same time, you know, said they're cliches for a reason. You know, they have a potency. But at the end of it, I mean, I just told them, everybody in this room, everybody that's here today, is wishing you the best, and it's a watershed moment in your life that you're standing here and you're about to embark on something new, and everyone here wishes you well. So, you know, just do something magnificent, whether it's small or large, and make yourself happy, and everyone in this room will be glad for you.
Oh, that sounds great. Great advice to get on your way off into life out of college, especially with the big student loan looming in front of you.
Yeah.
William Joyce, you've done so much. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, I had a great time. Thank you.
You too. That'll do it for today's exchange. Monday, we will talk about the National Cohesive Wildland Fire Management Plan. We'll talk about measles cases being up in Oregon and around the country. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the authors of the book, The Student Loan Mess. That was not an intentional plug right there at the end, but that's what's coming up Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Today, we say goodbye for the last time on air to Reed Newland, our student assistant for this year. Reed, thank you so much for everything. That'll do it for the exchange. Take care of yourself. Have a great weekend.